Good morning, everyone. That was very, very well done. Thank you. Very nice. It's nice. I think it's encouraging to see a new generation coming forward and getting involved in a very active way. So that's great. It's very, very good. I think most of us could look back on at different points in our lives, and we recognize the fact that over the course of time, in various aspects of life, we've encountered new or unusual situations. Might have been in school, if you can remember back to your first exposure to going to school, that was a big transition. Your first job was probably a memorable event in your life. But I think we understand that as we encounter situations like that, new events crop up in our lives, new responsibilities are put on us. Generally, when we face a situation like that, one of the very first things that we ask in some way, shape, or form is, what am I supposed to do? What's involved in this? I remember when I was, when I first went into the service, I'd gone through tech school several months in Mississippi, and then my first assignment was to be shipped with a number of other guys that I'd gone to school with to Germany, and that was my first duty assignment. And I remember the absolute angst that I experienced as I thought, have they really prepared you for what's ahead? Are you really capable of taking on these new responsibilities? And I was asking in a lot of different ways, what am I supposed to do? How do I do this? And how do I accomplish this new role that that I've been thrust into? I think many of us could also look back on our past and realize that as we began to engage in this calling that God's given us, as we began to have our minds opened and our understandings broadened, we came to the realization that the Bible has a great deal to reveal about how we should live our lives and how they should be structured, what we should accomplish. And that's a process that once introduced to, it will be with us for as long as we live. We will never learn all that there is to learn about how to apply the Bible in all the various aspects of our lives. We know that it is a lifelong challenge. But we also know that as we came to that understanding and we realized that the Bible provides us with an outline of how to live, we ask that same question. Okay, I see that God is telling us to do certain things. I see that there are certain outcomes that we ought to aim for. What should I do with this information? I think many of us experienced the reaction of those who listened to the sermon that Peter gave at that first New Testament observance of the Feast of Pentecost. That's recorded in Acts chapter 2, where it says, therefore, let all the house of Israel, this was part of Peter's words to the crowd that was gathered before him, let all the house of Israel know beyond doubt that God has made this Jesus, whom you crucified, both Lord and Christ. The people who were listening to Peter were suddenly confronted with a very profound and shocking truth that they had a part in the death and crucifixion of Jesus Christ and the sufferings that he had undergone. And as Peter brought that point out, many of the people were stricken by what they heard. Goes on to say, now when they heard this, they were acutely distressed, and they said to Peter and the rest of the apostles, what should we do, brothers? What do we do? We understand that what you have said, I think it had to occur to a number of them that his words were true when they thought about it. You know, that's a very foundational part of our understanding as we begin to realize that Jesus Christ was sent by the Father to live a sinless life, to set us the ultimate example, and that he died not just for that group of people that Peter was addressing, not just for a small handful, but as it tells us in the book of John, he died to cover the sins of the whole world. Now, that's a shocking and profound piece of news. And when we are confronted with that, we begin to ask that question reasonably. What do we do? We understand that we have to take action in some way, shape, or form, but sometimes we don't understand exactly how to go about it. Do you remember the first time you read Micah chapter 6? Micah chapter 6. Because it addresses the same issue. It says in Micah 6, verse 8, he has shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? What do we do? We see that there is a need for us to take action, just like those people that were there in the audience before Peter on that day of Pentecost. They understood that the message was pointed at them. Just as we come to that same understanding that the message that's contained in the Bible is pointed towards each and every one of us. And so we understand that we have to do something as we begin to gain information and understanding of God's Word. And so we ask this question, what should I do? And the answer is found here in Micah chapter 6. He has shown you what is good. What does the Lord require of you but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God? It's a very succinct expression of our responsibilities, but the application is profoundly challenging, I would say. It's not an easy thing to do. So much of what we, as we learn more and more about God's plan and our part in it, we understand that it's not always easy. The sermonette made that very clear, that we will face trials. And God understands that we have to face a certain amount of resistance in life. There has to be a certain amount of friction that we work against in order for us to develop the characteristics that he wants to see. To develop faith. To develop the understanding that, as was pointed out in the earlier message, God does deliver us. That only comes by experiencing challenges in life and seeing God's hand as he delivers us from various trials and difficulties. And so we understand that while the words seem simple in our reading, when we read Micah's statement, the impact is a much different situation. It's a much greater challenge than we first realized. But again, I would go back to the statement I made. Do you remember the first time that you read Micah 6, verse 8? How did it impact you at the time? Were you a little bit surprised to see such a direct answer given to a question? I was. I thought, wow, that's pretty simple. And again, you understand, it's a simple statement, but with a very profound message. It's a clear statement that nevertheless sometimes causes us to wonder about the nuts and bolts of it all. How do we apply the principles contained in that statement and others in the Bible on a daily basis in our lives? How do we, in practical terms, how do we apply these kinds this kind of information to our lives? One of the other translations renders Micah chapter 6, verse 8, says, He has shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justly, to love, well, that's the same thing we read, to walk humbly with your God. Today, what I want to do in the message is look at the first of those steps that Micah gives us to see how we can more effectively put it into practice. And I think to also help us understand just how important it is. And it's vitally important that we learn to apply what Micah tells us. So we're told in that first part of the answer, as it says in the Amplified Bible, what does God require of you? The first step, he expects us to be just. And so that's the first step in the process. From this, we begin to see how to apply this particular portion of the directive. If we take a little bit of an historical sidelight to this, we go back to Genesis chapter 6. There's an interesting statement made about one of the heroes of the Bible, Noah. It's in Genesis chapter 6. In verse 9. So this is the genealogy of Noah. Noah was a just man, perfect in his generations, and Noah walked with God. Noah, we could say, fulfilled or heeded the advice that was later given or codified by Micah. He was a just man. Now, I think when we consider the fact that Noah alone in his generation was the individual that God found acceptable in the way he lived his life, in the relationship that he maintained with his Creator, to the extent that it was only he and his family, and I would submit that his family were there only because of him, but you had one individual that God said, this individual is worthy for me to preserve and to use to establish the line, because the rest of humanity is going to be wiped out. They're going to be eradicated. So we begin to see just what level of importance this matter of being just takes on. When we see that that's one of the characteristics that describes Noah, and that he was an individual, it says, who walked with God. He was perfect in his ways. So we can see the importance of what we're told as we read Micah chapter 6 and verses similar to that. Now, according to the Keyword Study Bible, the word just is from the Hebrew tzaddik, and it means just or lawful or righteous. So Noah was a just, a lawful, and a righteous individual. The word perfect is from the Hebrew word tamim, and as it says in one of the reference sources, when used in a moral sense, this word is linked with truth, virtue, uprightness, and righteousness. I think Noah made at least some mistakes in his life, but his approach was focused on pursuing truth, valuing truth, pursuing virtue and uprightness and righteousness. You know, both Paul and Peter wrote admonitions about a Christian's need to love and to seek virtue in order to make it a part of our character. What I want to focus on is this aspect of justice, but we're going to take a couple of side trips just to kind of see the subject in a somewhat broader perspective. Turn to Philippians chapter 4. Philippians chapter 4. Because these words are linked together, they're synonymous in their meanings. Philippians 4, verse 8, "Finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are noble, whatsoever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there is any virtue, and if there is anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things." In that, within that group of characteristics and traits that God wants to find developing in his people, among those at the top of the list or toward the top of the list is being just, being lawful, being righteous, seeking to live our lives in that way. Not to say that we won't make mistakes. That's why God has made it, made provisions for us to repent, so that when we are made aware of sins that we've committed, of missing the mark, of falling short of what God's expectations for us are, we can repent and we can ask God's forgiveness and we can ask for the sacrifice of Jesus Christ to be applied so that we can be justified through Jesus Christ and reconciled with our Father. Turn also over to 2 Peter chapter 1. 2 Peter chapter 1. Peter says, "But also for this very reason, giving all diligence to add to your faith virtue, and to virtue knowledge, to knowledge self-control, to self-control perseverance, and to perseverance godliness." So again, it's all of these synonymous terms with being just, being virtuous, being righteous. Peter and Paul both admonish God's people to pursue those elements of character in their lives. We begin to see that what is stated in Micah is a theme that's continued throughout the New Testament. And it's continued by a multitude of writers, as we saw. You know, Paul delves into the subject, Peter as well. Turn to Matthew chapter 23. And we'll see another example of this. Matthew chapter 23. And here, Jesus Christ echoes the words that we read from Micah chapter 6. Matthew chapter 23, verse 23. This was at a time when Jesus Christ was confronting the religious hierarchy of the time, and was pointing out their need to change the focus of their lives. In verse 23, it says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone." He said you should do what you've been doing. You should tithe. You should be serious in your approach to it. You should do it to the best of your ability. But that should not be the focus, the main focus of your attention. You ought to do those things, but while you're doing those things, you ought to focus on the important issues in life, the matters of justice and mercy and faith, because those define how you live your life. How you tithe of your mint and your anise and your cumin shows, those are steps in the process. But how you apply justice, how you apply mercy, and how you exercise faith in your life are the things that are truly most meaningful. And that That point is made very clear there. Now here the word justice is from the Greek word krisis, and it can convey various thoughts depending on the context, depending on how the word is used. Once again, from the Keyword Study Bible, part of the commentary on this word says that right, justice, and equity, as we read in Matthew 23, and yet, it's quoting the verse, right, justice, and equity. And yet, let's also look over in Luke chapter 11. There's an interesting point that's made in Luke. Luke 11, verse 42, this is Luke's account of the same event. It said, "But woe to you, Pharisees, for you tithe the mint and the rue and all manner of herbs, and you pass by justice and the love of God. These things you ought to have done without leaving the others undone." You pass it by. You're oblivious to the important things. You're so focused on these minor details of how you go about accomplishing one aspect of what God tells us to do that you're ignoring. You're walking past and you're ignoring something much more important, the application of justice, mercy, and faith in your life. In the Keyword Study Bible, it renders it this way. It says, "And yet you disregard and neglect justice and the love of God." Matthew 23:23 from the Amplified Bible, it's rendered this way. It says, "Woe to you, self-righteous scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you give a tenth of your mint and dill and cumin, focusing on minor matters, and have neglected the weightier, the more important moral and spiritual provisions of the law, justice, mercy, and faithfulness. But these are the primary things you ought to have done without neglecting the others." So again, it's a matter of assigning priorities to different aspects of life. And God says, don't get caught up on the tiny, in many ways, inconsequential details to the exclusion of focusing on the important matters. In Luke 11:42, in the New Life Version, is rendered this way. It says, "It is bad for you, proud religious law keepers. You give one-tenth part of your spices, but you give no thought to what is right and to the love of God. You should do both of these." So they were, the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the scribes were taken to task by Jesus Christ because of what they were failing to do. There are several examples. We're going to look at a couple of them that show why he made the statement to them that he did. Right here in the book of Luke, turn to Luke chapter 13. Luke 13. This is an account about one of those confrontations that he had with the religious leaders of his day. Luke chapter 13, beginning in verse 10. Speaking about Christ, it said, "Now he was teaching in one of the synagogues on the Sabbath. And behold, there was a woman who had a spirit of infirmity 18 years and was bent over and could in no way raise herself up. And when Jesus saw her, he called her to him and he said to her, 'Woman, you are loosed from your infirmity.' And he laid his hands on her, and immediately she was made straight and glorified God." Now, let's pause there for a moment. What are we told in the book of John about the admonition given to us to bear fruit? Why? What is one of the paramount reasons that we are told we need to bear fruit? "That you may glorify your Father." That God is the focus of everything. And that's exactly what happened when this woman was healed. She immediately glorified God. But the ruler of the synagogue answered with indignation because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath. And he said to the crowd, "There are 6 days on which men ought to work. Therefore, come and be healed on them and not on the Sabbath day." The Lord answered and said to him, "Hypocrite, does not each one of you..." Now, think about this. Think about what the individual had said. Here was a woman who had been in this circumstance for 18 years. It doesn't say a lot about how much pain was a part of this suffering. But the simple fact that she had this situation to deal with for 18 years, you would think that someone having witnessed that would at least stop for just a moment and say, "That's amazing. I don't know how it was done, but it's amazing." They didn't. They took her to task. Some of the commentaries talk about this particular situation, and one of the commentators said that at least some of the Jewish authorities at the time believed that the only healing that should occur on the Sabbath would have been in a life or death matter. If someone were on the verge of dying, then it was probably okay to go ahead and heal that individual. But for just routine matters, you shouldn't do it. You should wait and come on one of the other days, come to the temple and get it taken care of. And then Jesus Christ answers these individuals and puts the whole matter in very stark, clear perspective. He said, "Hypocrite, does not each one of you on the Sabbath loose his ox or his donkey from the stall and lead it away to water it? And so ought this woman, being a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan has bound..." Think of it. For 18 years, shouldn't she be loosed from this bond on the Sabbath? And when he had said these things, all of his adversaries were put to shame, and all the multitude rejoiced for all the glorious things that were done by him. But contrast the two attitudes. They were concerned enough about their animals, and perhaps there was an economic motive. I've got money invested in this animal. If it doesn't do well, I don't do well. That may or may not have been a part of the reasoning. I don't know. But he made the stark contrast between the two. That you're willing to see to the care and the needs of your animal on this day. You're going to make sure that animal is watered and fed and is taken care of. And yet this woman, who has been in this condition for 18 years, you're willing to let that rest for a while? You're willing to put that over on the side and say, "Nah, let's take care of this one of these other days." You know, and as it said, they were ashamed once he had put it in that particular light. But that was the kind of attitude that he was dealing with at the time. Over in the book of Mark chapter 3. Mark chapter 3. Once again, it's this matter of focusing on the little things and bypassing or ignoring or neglecting the weightier matters of the law. Mark chapter 3 and verse 1. "And he entered the synagogue again, and a man was there who had a withered hand, and they watched him closely." He had their attention. And then it goes on to tell us why they watched him closely. "They watched him closely, whether he would heal on the Sabbath, so that they might accuse him." Not to see if God, is he who he claims to be? He claims to heal you know, through the power of God, that wasn't why they watched him. They watched him to try to find occasion to accuse him of something, of some violation. He said to the man who had the withered hand, "Step forward." And then he said to them, "Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill?" But they kept silent. And when he looked around at them with anger, being grieved by the hardness of their hearts, he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." And he stretched it out, and his hand was restored as whole as the other. Then the Pharisees went out and immediately plotted with the Herodians against him how they might destroy him. They bypassed the weightier matters. They weren't concerned with just treatment for this individual. Here's an individual who had been among them, who had suffered from this affliction for some period of time. And when he confronted them and asked, "Is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath?" they wouldn't commit. They wouldn't answer the question. They wouldn't say anything. They kept silent. And then when he healed the individual, when he once again demonstrated that he had this power to bring about healing, miraculous healing in a person's life, rather than rejoice over what they had seen, rather than reflect on the what a momentous thing this was that they had just witnessed, they used it as a rallying point with others to try to come up with some means of destroying this individual, because they saw what Jesus Christ was doing as a threat to their positions, to their status. And they knew that the people he was drawing more and more of an audience to himself, and they were concerned about their own situations. But what they did, while they focused on the minor matters, on having some of these other issues perhaps ceremonially correct, they were willing to ignore the fact that here was a man who had received God's mercy. They looked past and neglected the weightier matters of the law that define God's love. They weren't interested in that. We saw earlier that Noah was described as a man who was just, who was lawful, who is law-abiding and righteous. Now, clearly the issues of justice and the proper understanding of the application of the law are immutably tied together. They were in Noah's life, in his example, and they are in our lives as well. A lawful, law-abiding person will be striving to apply the law as God intends in every aspect of life, in how he or she relates to God and how he or she relates to their fellow man. Turn back to Matthew chapter 22. Matthew 22. In verse 34, we're going to pick up in the middle of the account. It said, "But when the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together. And one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question, testing him, saying, 'Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law?' And Jesus said to him, 'You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets.'" If you want to understand the law of God, understand that it defines what love truly is. First, love for God, respect, reverence for God. As you grow in the understanding of God's power, God's being, God's purpose, and what he's doing with humankind, then our respect, our love, our reverence for him ought to grow. It should be an ever-growing part of our character. And secondly, how we treat one another, how we express our love for our neighbor. Christ said, on these two principles, these very basic principles, loving God and loving your neighbor, on these hang all the law and the prophets. They are the weightier matters. Learning how to express love toward God and toward our fellow man. Those are foundational should be foundational in a Christian's life. Perhaps nowhere in the Bible is it shown more clearly the weight of our treatment, the weight of our treatment towards others, how much weight that carries in God's eyes. Here in Matthew, turn to Matthew chapter 25. Matthew chapter 25, here's a section of scripture you're very familiar with. We're going to start reading in verse 31. This is when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the holy angels with him, he will sit on the throne of his glory, and all the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate them one from another, as a shepherd divides his sheep from his goats. And he will set the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on the left. And the king will say to those on his right hand, come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. And the righteous will answer and say to him, Lord, when did we see you hungry? When did we feed you? When did we see you thirsty and give you a drink? When did we see you a stranger and take you in, or naked and clothe you? Or when did we see you sick or in prison and come to you? And the king will answer and say to them, assuredly, I say to you, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these my brethren, you did it to me. Where in there, in that list of qualifications that Jesus Christ is looking for in an individual, where does it address the accuracy of your tithing of the mint and the anise and the cumin? Where are those procedural steps addressed? They aren't. Said, when you did it unto the least of one of these, my brethren, you did it to me. And then he will say to those on the left hand, depart from me, you cursed, into everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, you gave me no food. I was thirsty, you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you did not take me in. I was naked, and you did not clothe me. I was sick and in prison, and you did not visit me. And they will also answer, saying, Lord, when did we see you in such a condition? And not minister to you. And he will answer them, saying, assuredly, I say to you, inasmuch as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. And these will go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. That is a very important concept. That is a salvational issue. The matter of how we treat one another, how willing we are to extend justice to other individuals, and to extend mercy when we have the opportunity to do so, or to express faith. Those are foundational, those are salvational issues that we need to focus on. And as Jesus Christ told the Pharisees and the scribes when he confronted them over that matter, of their tithing. These things you should have done. All of those things you should have done, but you should have focused more attention on the weightier matters, on how you relate to God and how you relate to your fellow man. Those are the important issues. It's a matter of equitable treatment. And that's something that God has been interested in from his very from the very first dealings that he had with humankind. When he began to work with that group of individuals, the descendants of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, that nation of Israel, God instructed them about the weightier matters. Turn back to Deuteronomy chapter 10. Early in the history of Israel, this was what God was talking to the people about, issues that were being brought to their attention. Deuteronomy 10, verse 17. For the Lord your God is God of gods and Lord of lords, the great God, mighty and awesome, who shows no partiality or takes no bribe. He administers justice for the fatherless and the widow, and loves the stranger, giving him food and clothing. If we are to become perfect as our Father in heaven is perfect, and if God administers justice for the fatherless and the widow, and expresses love for the stranger, giving him food and clothing, going back to what we read in Matthew chapter 25, is it not incumbent upon us to do the very same thing? Because ultimately we are to reflect the mind of God in how we live our lives and how we deal with other individuals. And to do that, we have to extend justice or equity in our treatment of other individuals, and we have to express love for them and in our willingness to give and to share what we have. Again, that was at the very outset of God's dealings with Israel. In this matter of equitable treatment, turn to Numbers chapter 27. I'd like to look at an example of that. Numbers 27. Because I think it leads us to a certain point, a certain understanding about this matter. This is the occasion when there were various judgments being made about the administration of different issues within the nation of Israel under Moses. Numbers chapter 27, beginning in verse 1, it says, Then came the daughters of Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, the son of so on down through the line. These daughters stood before Moses and before Eleazar the priest and before the leaders and all the congregation by the doorway of the tabernacle of meeting, and they said, Our father died in the wilderness, but he was not in the company of those who gathered together against the Lord. He was not one of the rebels. He wasn't with Korah, in the company of Korah, but he died in his own sin, and he had no sons. They went on to ask the question, Why should the name of our father be removed from among his family because he had no son? Give us a possession among our father's brothers. And so Moses brought their matter, their case, before the Lord. And the Lord spoke to Moses and said, The daughters of Zelophehad speak what is right. You shall surely give them a possession of inheritance among their father's brothers, and cause the inheritance of their father to pass to them. It's interesting that these daughters essentially raised an issue of equitable treatment. At that time, they did not stand to receive the inheritance of their father. It would have passed down to a male heir. And they raised a question. They said, This doesn't seem just. This doesn't seem equitable. This doesn't seem fair. And Moses, rather than making a spur-of-the-moment decision, I think set us an example. He took the matter to God. He approached God, and he laid it out before him. And God said, What these daughters have said is correct. They have a point. And so there was established among the Israelites at that point in time a standard of justice, a standard of equitable treatment that they were to then build out from there. But this was a God-sanctioned decision. actually it was God's decision that was simply transmitted through Moses. And he said, yes, what they say is correct. They should receive the inheritance. And they go on, it goes on to put some qualifiers in this, how it was done. They couldn't sell what they inherited, and several other issues. But the point I wanted to focus on was this matter of equity. They said, this isn't just the way this is being handled right now. And God said, they're right, it isn't. And it needs to be. So he set a pattern for us to look at various situations and to adopt a just and an equitable approach towards others. The word judgment that's used in this particular account is translated justice in other places. Again, it's a synonymous term. God goes on to tell Israel how the inheritance is to be passed down through a family, and he set for Israel a pattern, as I said, of equitable treatment of everyone who was a part of the nation of Israel. Learning to be equitable, learning to be fair and just in our treatment of others as an integral part of living justly, of following the admonition in Micah chapter 6. We're going to look at a couple of other examples. Turn to Leviticus chapter 19. And this matter of fairness, it has to do with fairness and how we treat others in a fair and equitable way. And we can see that it was very important to God that Israel learned this lesson and they put it into practice. And I think that it's just as true today. Look, Leviticus chapter 19, beginning in verse 33, it said, if a stranger dwells with you in your land, you shall not mistreat him. The stranger who dwells with you shall be to you as one born among you. And you shall love him as yourself, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt, and I am the Lord your God. You shall do no injustice in judgment, in measurement of length, weight, or volume. You shall have honest scales, honest weights, an honest ephah, and an honest hin. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. God ties this whole matter into the stranger among them. And he reminded Israel that you were strangers yourself. You know what it is to be treated unjustly, unfairly. And so you're to take steps to avoid doing that within the nation of Israel. And one of the ways that you are to do that is to be sure that you have honest weights and measures. One of the commentaries brings out that it was not an unknown situation for someone to maintain two sets of weights. You had two sets of weights. You had one set of weights that you used when you bought something. And there was just enough of a discrepancy in the actual trueness of the weights that when you bought, according to your weights, a pound of something, you might get 2 or 3 ounces more. But you didn't use those weights when you sold product to someone else. You used a second set of weights. And those set of weights, when you sold a pound of something, you were actually giving up maybe 13 or 14 ounces. You shaved a little bit off. In our modern society, you hear an awful lot of talk about enhancing the bottom line. Well, that's what they were doing. They were enhancing the bottom line. I'll buy on these weights, get a little bit more for my money, but I'll sell with these weights, and I'll retain a little bit more of my money. God said, don't do that. Don't do that. You were mistreated. You were treated unjustly as slaves in Egypt. Don't impose that on somebody else. Don't impose that, especially on a stranger who comes in among you. Don't take advantage of someone else in this way. There are other cases like this where it talks about God considering the dishonest weights an abomination. It's something that he finds deplorable. And there were other things that Israel was warned about not to do. You can go through the Old Testament and read the occasions where God tells Israel, don't take a bribe. Don't take a bribe. Don't take a gift. And if you are in a position of authority, that is even more important. Because taking a bribe, taking a gift, perverts judgment. It throws off the scale of justice. And you have what we have in society at large today. You have a shifting scale of justice. You have one set of justice, or one level of justice that's applied here to this individual in this situation, but you have a different set that's applied to this person over here, to someone who has a little less clout, a little less prestige, and a little less standing. God says, don't do those things. Don't have dishonest scales. Don't take a bribe. Don't pervert justice. And especially, remember where you came from. Remember what you experienced, or at least your antecedents, what they experienced in Egypt. They weren't treated fairly. I delivered them from that. They cried out to me because of that, and I delivered them from that nation. God said, don't do that. Don't let that be a part of your conduct as well. Let's see if I want to turn to Exodus chapter 23. We're going to look at one other example real quickly. Again, this goes back to the very earliest history of Israel as a nation, what God was telling them to do. And it had to do with this matter of justice and equity and fairness and how they dealt with other individuals. Exodus chapter 23, verse 1. You shall not circulate a false report. Do not put your hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. You shall not follow a crowd to do evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after many to pervert justice. Don't give false testimony. And when we think about how that took place in the steps leading up to Jesus Christ's death, they suborned perjury. They got lying witnesses. They told lies about him. They perverted justice. That was perhaps the ultimate expression of that whole issue. You shall not show partiality to a poor man in his dispute. You know, we tend to think of showing favor to the rich, to the well-connected. But God said, sometimes we can swing to the other end of the pendulum, and we can show partiality to the poor man. God said, don't show partiality. Judge a matter on the facts, regardless of the circumstances of the individuals involved. It goes on to say, if you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, you shall surely bring it back to him again. If you see the donkey of one who hates you lying under its burden, and you would refrain from helping it, you shall surely help him with it. You shall not pervert the judgment of your poor in his dispute. Keep yourself far from a false matter. Do not kill the innocent and righteous, for I will not justify the wicked. And you shall take no bribe, for a bribe blinds the discerning and perverts the words of the righteous. Also, you shall not oppress a stranger, for you know that the heart of a stranger, because you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Those were that was part of the foundation upon which the nation of Israel was to be built. And we today, as spiritual Israel, are to be built upon the same foundation. How we treat other people is very, very important. It's critically important. One final scripture, turn to Psalm chapter 37. Psalm Psalm 37, verses 28 and 29. For the Lord loves justice, and he does not forsake his saints. They are preserved forever, but the descendants of the wicked shall be cut off. The righteous shall inherit the land and dwell in it forever. That word righteous is from that Hebrew word tzaddik, and it can mean, among other things, just. So we could render Psalm 37:29, the just shall inherit the land and dwell in it forever. The Bible clearly shows that from the earliest history of God's dealings with mankind, his intent for us is always that we be just in our dealings with one another. The process of separating the sheep from the goats shows us that learning to do so properly is truly a salvation issue. Let's strive to focus on the weightier matters of the law: loving God above all else, and learning to treat others as we would want to be treated ourselves, in a way that is fair and equitable and just.